listening to Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. Our program is produced weekly in sunny Sarasota, Florida at WSLR 96.5 LPFM, Sarasota's community radio station. Listen live on the radio, on the internet, on your smartphone, or at your convenience through our downloadable podcast at maternallyyoursradio.com.
Our mission is to support our listeners in growing empowered families that create empowered communities. Each week, we bring you evidence-based information for your journey through the childbearing years. We do not give medical advice, and with all subjects, we suggest that you thoroughly research your options and speak with an appropriate expert with whom you have a relationship of mutual trust and respect.
The voices you'll hear in the next hour belong to the Maternally Yours Collective and our guests, and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of this radio station, its board of directors, or station management. The conversation may include descriptive language or emotionally sensitive subject matter. We respect all families and understand that it is up to each of us to make the most informed choice possible. We are Maternally Yours.
We are Maternally Yours.
We are Maternally Yours. Welcome to the conversation.
Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. I'm Dana King, domestic goddess and mama to Elliot, maternal mental health advocate and cesarean education supporter. Tonight, we welcome guest co-host April Noss. I'm so excited you're here. April is mama to Kai and Ren, a musician, foodie, herbal medicine enthusiast, yogi, martial artist, traveler, and environmentalist. She and her husband own Sarasota Karate Club, a traditional Japanese karate school. Thanks for being my partner in crime tonight.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Hooray! So, everybody, in addition to hearing us live on WSLR each and every Tuesday, you can hear us on Wool 91.5 FM in Bellows Falls, Vermont, KPOV 88.9 FM in Bend, Oregon, WCRS 102.1 in 98.3 FM in Columbus, Ohio, the Detour Network in East Tennessee, and Geneva Community Radio in the Finger Lakes region of New York State. So check your local listings for our time slot, and as always, find us online at maternallyyoursradio.com or on iTunes. So now, here's some
birth in the news.
Yeah. A new statement from the World Health Organization underscores the importance of focusing on the needs of the patient on a case-by-case basis and discourages the practice of aiming for, quote, target rates. A cesarean section is one of the most common surgeries in the world, and the rates continue to rise, particularly high in middle-income countries. Cesarean sections are often performed without medical need, and they put women and babies at risk of short and long-term health problems. The procedure can save lives in instances of prolonged labor, fetal distress, or because of abnormal baby positioning. However, they can also cause significant complications, disability, or even death. The risk is particularly high in settings that lack the facilities necessary for safe surgeries and the treatment of all potential complications. The international healthcare community has considered the ideal rate of this procedure to be between 10 and 15% since 1985. The effects of cesarean section rates on maternal and newborn outcomes such as stillbirths and morbidities are still unknown, and the research on women's psychological and social well-being is still lacking. There are also issues with the increased cost of this procedure, potentially pulling resources from other needed services. The World Health Organization is proposing adopting the Robson classification as an internationally applicable cesarean section classification system, meant to help monitor and compare rates to better understand trends and their locations. This system would classify all women into one of 10 groups based on characteristics like number of previous pregnancy, whether the baby comes head first, gestational age, previous uterine scars, number of newborns, and how labor got started.
Okay. A 65-year-old German woman may soon become the oldest person ever to give birth to quadruplets. Annegret Ronick is already given birth to 13 children and is pregnant again as a result of IVF treatment using both donated sperm and eggs. When asked why she decided to try and have another child, Ronick said that her youngest daughter, age 9, wanted a younger brother or sister. She is currently in her 21st week of pregnancy, and although the English and Russian teacher was shocked when the ultrasound revealed she was carrying quadruplets, she does not believe there will be any problems with the pregnancy as she intends to remain healthy and fit. Her 13 children, ranging all from ages 9 to 44, have separate fathers, and Ronnie currently has 7 grandchildren. She tells those who question her decisions, "I think one needs to decide for oneself and not listen too much of the opinions of others."
Don't laugh while you're doing birth in the
She tells reporters that she finds the cliché surrounding her 65-year-olds to be rather tiring. She is currently not considering selective reduction at this point in her pregnancy, a process where one or more fetuses is terminated so that the pregnancy can continue with at least one child. Although surprising to Ronick, multiple pregnancies have been on the rise due to IVF. She is quoted saying to the German newspaper Bild, "At first, I only wanted one child. Not all were planned, but then these things happen. I'm not a planner, but rather spontaneous, and children keep me young." The world's oldest mother is thought to have given to birth at 69 in a remote Indian village of Hisar. To add to these odds, statistically, the chances of having quadruplets are around 1 in 142,000.
What do you want to say? I know you were choking back the laughter while you were trying to read that.
Nothing. I'll keep it to myself.
I mean, it has definitely set the internet on fire, that's for sure.
Yeah.
65. Time to retire? No, I can just have 4 babies instead.
Because I can.
Oh, my gosh. All right, everybody. If you have some birth in the news to share, like that fantastic story, send it to us by email at maternallyyoursradio@gmail.com, or you can post it to facebook.com/maternallyyours. And for links to all of our birth in the news stories, please visit tonight's epilogue on our website. It'll be up at maternallyyoursradio.com. So tonight's show, sadly and happily, is going to be the last that I'm going to produce with a guest co-host, because we're going to be welcoming Ryan and Arbor back into the studio next week for our fantastic fun drive show.
Woo woo!
It's been really great for me, I think, and for our show, inviting all of these super dynamic mamas into our little radio world, working with fresh ideas and fresh perspectives. Ugh, I am tongue-tied tonight, everybody. So our co-host tonight, April, was a natural, that's a pun, a natural choice for me to invite to the show, not just because I'm lucky enough to call her my friend, but she and I also co-hosted a music show.
We did.
Some months back together, and I think that we had a good time like on that collaboration, so I asked her if she would be interested in coming and doing the talk vibe. You know, I asked each woman that came on and did guest co-hosting what topics were close to their heart or minds at that moment in their mothering journey, and that's kind of how this particular episode started to come together. April, do you want to tell everybody a little bit about why you have a passion for this kids in nature topic?
Yes, no pun intended again, but it does come natural to me. I'm lucky enough to grow up spending most of my time in, unstructured, outside, in nature. And I do think that kids spending most of their time, playtime in nature, is imperative to healthy development.
Absolutely.
And I definitely, it makes me feel better when I take a walk outside. And I do notice a difference in my children when they, you know, have that time to breathe fresh air and to explore and to run around. So.
Well, and here we are. So we're going to get things started with our first guest tonight. Reed Noss is Provost Distinguished Research Professor at the University of Central Florida and President of the Florida Institute for Conservation Science. He received an MS degree in ecology from the University of Tennessee and a PhD in wildlife ecology from the University of Florida. He has served as Editor-in-Chief of Conservation Biology, President of the Society for Conservation Biology, and President of the North American Section of the Society. He is an elected fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. His current and recent research projects include studies of the vulnerability of species and ecosystems to sea level rise, climate adaptation strategies, disturbance ecology, road ecology, ecosystem conservation and restoration, and changes in ecological processes and species Assemblages among urban, rural, wildland gradients. This is the best bio ever. He has more than 300 publications, including 7 books, and is rated as one of the 500 most highly cited authors in all fields worldwide. His latest book is called Forgotten Grasslands of the South, Natural History and Conservation. He is currently writing a book on fire ecology in Florida. Thanks for joining us tonight, Dr. Naz. Are you there? Can you hear us?
I'm here. Thanks, Dana and April, for having me on the show.
Hi, Dad.
Hey, April.
April said earlier that she was kind of happy you're not here in person because she didn't think she'd be able to stop herself from laughing constantly.
That could happen.
It probably would. I still might laugh, so. Well, that's okay.
Thank you, we
like laughing.
Yeah.
So let's just kick it right off. For our first question, I want to know, do you remember a specific occasion when you fell in love with nature, or you realized that was a passion of yours when you were a child?
Well, to be honest, I cannot remember ever not being in love with nature. And so I think, in my case, probably also for a lot of people, it wasn't, you know, a single experience. It was a whole stream of experiences that began at a very early age, before we were even able to remember discrete experiences. And I do know and can recall that as I grew older and started learning more about nature, my appreciation grew. So there, in my case at least, and I know for many people in my field, probably the vast majority, learning about nature increased our appreciation, because it helps you develop, you know, wonder and curiosity and awe, and to try to seek more knowledge. You know, as an example of that, I'm sure every child at some point, you know, recognizes that not every tree looks the same, and there may be different kinds of trees, but they don't have a really firm concept about species of trees. In my case, I had a grandfather, my maternal grandfather, who knew a lot about trees. That was his hobby, dendrology, the study of trees. And so at a very early age, again, before I can even remember, probably from the time I was 1 or 2 years old, he started taking me out and teaching me different kinds of trees. And so by the time I was 5 or so, I had a pretty good working knowledge of the trees of Ohio. And so that, you know, helped me develop then later as a naturalist and start learning things on my own with the help of field guides and so on.
Wow, that's a great story.
So where are we headed in conservation that makes it imperative for the future of generations to have a growing respect and love for the outdoors?
Well, in my opinion, the very most important reason for getting kids out into nature is that they can develop into conservation-minded citizens later on. I say this because I firmly believe that the greatest crisis of our time is mass extinction, where we're losing species on Earth at a rate more than 1,000 times the natural background rate. But yet, when people learn about nature and experience nature, especially beginning in early childhood, they develop a respect for nature. They start to feel empathy and compassion for other living things, and they don't want to see those things hurt. So you develop a love for nature, and you want to protect what you love. You don't want to see those species go extinct. So that, I believe, is the most important reason for going out into nature as it relates to conservation.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, it's scary. It gives me goosebumps just hearing those statistics. What do you think, in your opinion, what has changed over the last couple of generations that has caused this disconnect between people and the natural world?
Well, I think, you know, it's pretty obvious, and it's been documented in many studies, that kids spend a lot more time indoors these days than they used to. One recent study found that the average child in the United States spends just 7 minutes outdoors daily.
That's unbelievable.
Which is just crazy.
It is.
Given the time that most kids in my generation, at least, and at least one generation afterwards, spent outdoors. And so they also, not only are they indoors, but kids today, most kids become totally infatuated and even addicted to electronic devices, ranging from television and video games to smartphones and so on, again, at an increasingly early age. And so they're out of touch with the natural world. It doesn't even exist for them if they don't experience it as individuals. And also, I think a real big problem is our educational system. When I was a kid, there were regular field trips to outdoor locations. We had recess. And I know during recess for me in elementary school, I would get in trouble for this, but still I'd continue to leave the school grounds and go play in the adjacent woods, often by myself.
Yeah.
Increasingly, though, that was reined in, not just at school, but this whole safety-first philosophy emerged where it's thought that going outside is dangerous, and especially dangerous is unsupervised play, which is very ironic because recent research, some of it was discussed by Richard Louv in his book, Last Child in the Woods, but there's been other research since then that shows that unsupervised play out of doors is the very most important kind of play for stimulating intelligence, creativity, all the things we should want to encourage in children. And yet, as we know from a recent event, parents can get arrested for having their kids outdoors unsupervised. That's exactly the wrong direction. In fact, it's much safer to be outdoors today than it was when I was a kid. Violent crime, child abductions, all those are way, way down. It's much safer to be a kid now than probably any time in history. So the safety-first philosophy really has no strong basis.
No, it doesn't. No. It just makes people feel more comfortable, I think. You know, and that's one of the reasons we had you on is because, not just because of, you know, in your
nepotism
profession, but also, you know, as a parent and grandparent, I spent, you know, much of my youth outside. More than half of my time was spent unsupervised and outside in nature or with you, you know, nearby, going on hikes, exploring. And I think that definitely contributed to the person that I am. So, and I hope to give, you know, the same to Kai and Rin.
You definitely are.
So what can we do to foster a natural connection between children and non-human life on Earth?
Well, you know, I think a connection between a child's mind and nature is there from birth. This is an idea that's been called biophilia. Mm. There's a famous biologist still alive and still very active in his 80s, Edward O. Wilson, or E. O. Wilson as he's often called, who he didn't coin the term, but he promoted this concept of biophilia, which means an attraction to and love for living things, basically. And Wilson suggested that biophilia was innate, that it's genetically based. It varies. Some people have stronger biophilia than others, but everybody has it. And this was favored during our evolution, probably because knowing a lot about nature means we knew what was safe to eat, what was not safe to eat, what animals could kill us in various ways, and which were, you know, safe, and so on. Mm-hmm. So being affiliated and interested in life is very natural for us. The problem now is that parents, teachers, society in general do their best to turn that biophilia off. And simply by not turning it off, by encouraging it as the child grows, by nurturing biophilia, we can keep it alive in children and into their adulthood. Wow. It really shouldn't be that hard.
It really isn't.
It shouldn't be, and I would say it probably isn't for most, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe it's not most anymore. I think we are lucky because we have access to a lot of things in our community and a lot of great natural outdoor places to bring our children regularly. Maybe people who are in the big city, it's not the same situation for them, but...
Yeah, you know, that really varies. In Florida, we're actually lucky. Most big cities have some pretty good parks.
Right.
And even like New York City, for example, has Central Park, which mm-hmm. is an immense park, much of it natural area. So there are cities, very, very large cities, that have extensive open space that people do have access to. But there are others that have very, very little natural open space. In fact, what urban planners call open space might constitute, you know, soccer fields and playgrounds and so on, and have really no natural or even semi-natural habitat at all. So it varies quite a bit. There are definitely communities where kids do not have much access to natural areas unless they get it through their school system going mm-hmm. on field trips, which, as I noted earlier,
right.
does not happen as often in most school districts as it used to. But still, I think from what I've read and observed, most communities, even big urban areas, people still have access to nature if they seek it out, and if parents and teachers encourage the kids to seek it out.
Right. So it goes back to values, what you value.
Exactly.
The core
right.
of the family.
Exactly.
Yes.
Do you,
Roma,
do you believe that those in the conservation movement should be working towards connecting people with nature, that the children and nature movement should be sort of a prerequisite for the conservation movement?
Yes, I think the conservation movement and the children and nature movement naturally go together. They need each other by, again, educating kids or just providing experiences for kid outdoors, as I noted earlier or suggested earlier, is probably going to make them more empathetic towards nature and therefore make them more conservation-minded as adults.
Yeah.
It's not something that every person needs to be involved in both movements, if you will. You know, I know people who are childless, who even don't particularly like children, but are nevertheless very effective conservationists.
Uh-huh.
And then there are people who are very effective at getting kids out into nature, but don't participate much in conservation. I think there needs to be more dialogue and interaction between the two groups. And then there are many people who are involved with both movements. I think we need to encourage more interaction.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So, understandably, there are many people that are concerned about the unintended consequences of more people out in nature, ecological damages in protected areas, and by setting various rules and regulations in natural areas, are we prohibiting the very kinds of activities that helped each other, you know, fall in love with nature in the first place by setting up these lines and these rules and boundaries?
Well, that's a very challenging question, and one that many of us in the conservation movement think about daily, because there really are true trade-offs between preserving nature and getting people out into nature. We know that even very seemingly, you know, non-disruptive types of activities like hiking and bird watching can have real impacts on certain sensitive species. For example, many birds do not nest near hiking trails.
Yeah.
Or if they do nest near hiking trails, their young don't survive because they're constantly being flushed off the nest by people coming by, and so the eggs mm-hmm. and then the nestlings don't get enough attention.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some animals that even the presence of a person or the scent of a person in the landscape. This is true for some large predators who are persecuted by people. Even the scent of a person in the landscape can make them leave that landscape.
Wow.
So how do we get around this problem? Because
right.
I really think that every individual needs access to nature. I think we need to provide that access all the way from dense urban areas out into agricultural areas and wildlands. But I think the only way we can reconcile these two needs is to have some large wild areas with limited access, not necessarily no access, but just don't build a lot of trails.
Okay.
Definitely don't have a lot of roads.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, no roads. Mm-hmm. And so it makes it a little tougher to get into, so not many people will go in there anyway. And these species that are more sensitive to human activity will be able to prosper. And I hate to almost say this on this show that kind of celebrates birth, but the biggest environmental problem is human overpopulation.
Yes.
And this is a definite problem in terms of trying to reconcile this conflict between getting people out of nature and protecting sensitive species and sensitive natural areas.
So hence my laughter with the story I was reading.
Yeah, exactly. 14 kids.
With a woman with the 14 kids.
And she's going to have four more kids. So what is one thing in regards to conservation of our planet and natural resources that kids can do that will show them that their actions matter on this wonderful planet that we're lucky to call home?
So what can kids do? Well, I think, again, they're going to need some guidance, especially these days where they're not going to get it necessarily from their parents.
Mm-hmm, right.
But I would like to, I think a big onus here falls on teachers. We, first of all, need to do a better job of educating all teachers, beginning with preschool teachers, mm-hmm. certainly kindergarten on up. Educating them about nature so that they feel comfortable teaching kids about nature and bringing kids outdoors into nature and letting them know of the research that shows how nature benefits children and adults. It makes us smarter. It makes us healthier psychologically and physically. There's abundant research that documents that.
Right.
But given that, what can kids do? Kids, once they get to a certain age, are capable of making choices about what they read, about what they do with their free time, and kids can help educate their parents,
yes.
and even their teachers
yes.
about
their
nature
peers.
If uh-huh. they take the time to learn themselves.
Mm-hmm. So I personally have had this question a lot from people because they know that I bring my children to my ECA, you know,
you're right.
and I get this question. So the question is, what are some good safety tips for exploring our Florida woods with young kids? So a lot of people fear, you know, venomous snakes,
spiders, gators, poisonous plants,
without
mosquitoes.
Getting into particulars with each, you know, species. How can parents get past that fear and enjoy going out with their children?
Well, I think knowledge is the best way to overcome these fears. You can learn what's dangerous and what's not. As I mentioned earlier, our ancestors certainly had to learn these things.
Yeah.
Important to know what the dangerous plants and animals are, mm-hmm. so that you can recognize them and avoid stepping on a venomous snake, for example. But also, you need to know the level of risk associated with these various potentially dangerous things in nature, because, you know, the chance of, even if you're outdoors all the time, camping off trail in Florida or other places with lots of venomous snakes, your right. chances of being bit are extremely small.
Yes.
And you know, I've hiked off trail in Florida for a total of 18 years and I've never been bitten by a snake. Now, that doesn't mean it won't happen, but your chances are very low, much, much less than dying in a car accident driving on your way to a park.
Right.
And people need to realize that. But then after that, you know, realizing the level of risk, it is important to know about what's dangerous and what's mm-hmm. And that's just common sense.
So we need more education for moms and dads so they cannot be so freaked out about going outside. Then the children won't be freaked out about going outside.
Yes,
and then maybe people can stop calling the police when your kids are outside.
Yes, exactly.
By themselves, unattended,
yep.
doing mystery things. Hmm. What else have you got over there, April? I see you in your notebook.
Well, do you have any last comments, Dad, that you would like to add before we end?
I'm getting a lot of static, so
okay.
I can't hear even off of the speakerphone.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
A little bit better.
Okay.
It's still static, but you're a little louder.
Okay. Do you have any last comments before we end?
Well, I think one earlier question that you sent that we haven't addressed is what can we do, you know, as parents and grandparents to get children out into nature and appreciating nature? And I think most important is leading by example, making outdoor activity a family activity.
Yeah.
And as April well knows, our kids really didn't have any choice. You know, we dragged them along hiking their entire lives.
Oh, yes. I have heard a yarn or two about it.
All day long, you know, in the heat in Florida or out in the desert in Oregon and
these,
so on.
Yeah, these are true stories.
And there was some rebellion against that, but all the kids came to love nature. And now, you know, using April as an example, this is what she does with her own kids.
Yeah.
So the good experiences the kids have out there outweigh the exhaustion and the insects and the heat and everything else.
Yes, they do.
So, but you have to make it fun. You got to go out. You got to look for cool stuff. Natural history is inherently interesting. So teaching kids about bugs, about snakes and turtles and frogs and cool plants and so on makes it fun. It's fun for the whole family, not just for the kids. It's fun for the adults as well. So it's really an all-age type of activity.
It really is the best family activity, is going on a hike. Very simple, and it doesn't cost anything.
Well, there you go. Good thing my grandpa didn't call in just now. He'd be laughing all the way to the other side of the country, because they would always make me go hiking, and I was like the world's worst complainer. Oh, you know, but if I could go back and hike to the next waterfall again, I totally would right now. So
I know, me too.
There you go.
I'm sure, we have some stories of me at 15 not wanting to go anywhere with them.
Well, and look, now we're dragging the next generation out there, and we're making them enjoy it, because these are the moments.
Yep, it is.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us so much, Dr. Noss. It was so great to talk to you. I hope you have a great evening, and good luck with your next project. Any idea when that book is coming out?
I'm hoping it'll be out no later than 2017. It takes a while to write a book and then to get it published.
Yes, it does.
It's been accepted at the basic project, but let's go through review and all that. So maybe by 2017, my Fire Ecology of Florida book will be out.
Woo-hoo. Awesome.
Learning about fire is another very important thing for children, actually.
Yes, we actually saw one out near Myakka, and Kai made me drive out there to see where it was coming from, because he really wanted to see.
Fire is a very important part of Florida's ecology, and kids and adults need to understand that a lot better.
Yes, it's important.
Awesome.
Well, thank you, Dad. It was great talking to you.
Okay, thanks again for inviting me.
Have a great night.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So you're listening to Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. When we return from a short break, we'll continue the conversation about kids in nature with paleontologist Dr. Scott Sampson.
Programming on WSLR is made possible by support from our listeners, as well as Sarasota's midwives who welcome babies gently and build community locally with Kathy Matthews, Home Birth, Birthways Family Birth Center, and Rosemary Birthing Home.
So everybody, you still have time. Right now it is about 6:30 locally, Sarasota people. Cruise on down for free cone day. Dun, da, da, da. I was there earlier with my son. It was awesome. You can join WSLR at Ben & Jerry's for free ice cream today. Every year, Ben & Jerry's holds a free cone day to help inspire people to donate to a local organization they support. This year, that cause is WSLR. WSLR programmers and volunteers are right now at Ben & Jerry's on St. Armand Circle until 8 p.m. Like I said, cones are free and all donations received go to benefit WSLR. For more information, you can cruise over to wslr.org. Meet dozens of local farmers and artisan food producers, sample some of our area's best local food and drink, enjoy live music, and mingle with fellow foodies at Transitions Sarasota's second semi-annual local food entrepreneur showcase. Though this event is part of a wider effort to bring together those interested in helping to grow our local food economy through direct investment with those who are seeking capital to start up or expand their local food-based businesses, you don't have to think of yourself as an investor or an entrepreneur to participate. All are welcome to join in the fun on Sunday, April 19th at Fogartyville here, 525 Comcot Court from 4 to 8 p.m.
Postpartum Society of Florida invites you to a volunteer informational meeting on April 16th at 6:30 p.m. at 1958 Prospect Street in Sarasota. Gather for wine and cheese and learn about volunteer opportunities with Postpartum Society of Florida. Whether your interest is contributing services and goods from your small business, administrative and office help, or training to become a postpartum sister mentor for a new mom, your gifts are exactly what we need to support and strengthen families in our community.
ICANN of Sarasota is hosting their annual Mom Prom on April 25th at 8 p.m. at Fogartyville Community Arts Center, 525 Comcot Court. How many times can I say that address today? This event is a ladies-only night out, food, drinks, raffle, dancing, photo booth, and tons of fun. Dig out your own prom gowns, wedding gowns, bridesmaids' dresses, or grab something new. Have fun with all the ladies while supporting a great cause. For more information, you can go to facebook.com/ICANN of SRQ.
Would you like us to announce the birth of a baby, a nursing milestone, or a family-friendly event? Please post to our Facebook page, facebook.com/maternallyyours, or email us at maternallyyoursradio@gmail.com. And for a complete listing of Sarasota's family-friendly events, be sure to pick up your copy of Mommy Magazine found on news racks throughout the community.
So you're listening to Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. You can find this in all of our recent podcasts on our website, maternallyyoursradio.com, where you'll also find an epilogue including any resources and links we mentioned tonight in the show. So we're going to continue our conversation about kids in nature, although our next guest is a little bit delayed calling in, but I can tell everybody how excited I am to speak to this man when he does phone in. You know, if you've ever watched Dinosaur Train, which if you're a parent, I'm guessing you've probably seen it at least 1,200 times. Dr. Scott Sampson is the paleontologist on that show, and, you know, my son talks about him like he is, like, cooler than Batman. Dr. Scott! Where's Dr. Scott? Mom, yes. What are you going to say to Dr. Scott? So,
yes, my kids were equally excited. Kai has been watching that show since he was two, so he's pretty thrilled that I will be speaking to him.
Ah, look, look, here's the magic light. Dun 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 dun.
Hello.
Hello. Dr. Scott, is that you?
It is, and I'm sorry, I just realized that I was supposed to call you guys. I was waiting for you to call me.
Oh, no. It all worked out. Well, oh. Thank you.
We were sweating bullets over here for a minute. Nice job.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
No worries at all. April, would you like to introduce Dr. Scott?
Yes. Dr. Scott Sampson is a dinosaur paleontologist and science communicator. He serves as vice president of research and collections at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and as Dr. Scott, the paleontologist, host on PBS Kids television series Dinosaur Train. How to Raise a Wild Child is his most recent book, and it's a wonderful book. I thoroughly enjoyed reading How to Raise a Wild Child. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yay! So let's just get right into it. Why do children need nature, and why does nature need children, Dr. Scott?
Wow. So children need nature for every aspect of their health. The average kid today spends 7 to 10 hours every day looking at screens, 4 to 7 minutes playing outdoors. A U.S. Surgeon General said not so long ago that this generation of kids may be the first to have a life expectancy less than that of their parents because of conditions like diabetes, obesity, attention deficit disorder, depression, inflammatory diseases, all these different things.
turns out that that's not even the end of it. The kids need nature for their minds as well as their bodies. It helps them be creative, more imaginative, helps them to relax, it reduces stress, all these things. So that's why kids need nature. Now, to answer the second part, why does nature need kids? I'd go so far as to say the current sustainability crisis depends on us connecting kids with nature. Yes. Go ahead and ask, you know, 50 or 100 scientists what are the most pressing issues of our time, and you will hear answers like climate change, species extinctions, and the destruction of habitats. And my position is they are absolutely right, and you cannot solve those crises unless people care about where they live. And why would they possibly care if they don't spend any time outdoors? So I'm part of this last generation in the woods, this last generation that was brought up playing outside. And if we grow up and grow old and the next generation hasn't sent their kids outside, guess what?
We're in trouble.
We're going to have this complete disconnect from nature,
Absolutely. So in your book, you mentioned that a meaningful connection to nature does not arise in a single emotionally charged event. But do you remember, as a child, what fueled your passion for nature?
Absolutely. And so when I write that about nature connection, what I'm saying is it takes years to really build a bond. It's like, you know, falling in love with somebody. Some people say it can happen overnight. But for that deep kind of connection, it takes a longer time, more contact. Having said that, there can be powerful experiences, whether you're talking about an individual or falling in love with nature. And I certainly had experiences like that when I was a kid. Excuse me. In the book, I write about being about 4 or 5 years old and my mother taking me to this pond and wading into the pond and my mother just sort of smiling and letting me go until the water's over my waist and I'm picking up these tadpoles. And it was the first time in my life that I can recall feeling completely and utterly connected with everything around me, like there was no difference between the pond and me. And so that was a powerful moment in my life that I remember, like, you know, it was not quite yesterday, but a few days ago, say. And it's had a deep impact on me to this day. And I wonder about kids that may not have that kind of experience.
Yeah. So how do we do this? How do we help children not just love being out in nature, but also grow a respect and develop a passion for nature preservation?
Yeah, one of the key steps is for grown-ups, the parents, the teachers, the other caregivers, to start valuing nature. And the reality is, if we grown-ups don't value nature at all, it's unlikely that kids will.
Yeah.
And it's as easy as walking out the door and stopping for 10 seconds before you get into the car or go wherever you're going. Just stop and pause and look up. And what are the clouds like? What does the air feel like? Can you hear any birds? What does the grass feel like? And just by doing that, you are valuing nature. And kids, of course, watch what we do. And that's as important or more than what we say, of course, most of the time. And so just by valuing nature that much, that helps kids value it too. Even better, if you don't have a passion for something outdoors, find one. Whether it's birding or artwork or hiking or surfing or skiing or whatever it might be, find a passion and take kids with you. Because if you do that, once again, you're showing that you value nature, and the kids are much more likely to do exactly the same.
So true. That whole lead by example is the way to go.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So most of us know you from the PBS show Dinosaur Train. Can you tell us about how you became involved with the show and why?
Sure. I got a phone call from a Jim Henson Company executive saying, listen, we're putting together this brand new show for PBS all about dinosaurs. Would you like to get involved? And I said, well, that sounds interesting. What are you calling it? And she said, well, it's going to be called Dinosaur Train. And I said, you can't call it that. And she said, how come? And I said, because I'm a paleontologist, and I spent a bunch of my time trying to convince people that humans and dinosaurs didn't live at the same time. You can't go stick them both on trains. And she said, don't worry.
we're only going to put dinosaurs on the train. And I stopped and I paused and I went, well, that's just brilliant. Holy cow. It's like chocolate and peanut butter if you're 4 years old, right?
Yeah.
That's how I got involved as a science advisor, and then they asked me to become the host of the show because I'd done a bunch of TV before. And I have to say, it has been a blast. If people are thinking, they might be going, well, hold on a sec. This guy's a hypocrite because here he is telling us to go out into nature, but he's creating this super attractive, or at least he's involved in creating this very attractive television show that helps to addict kids to screens. And that's why I argued for this punchline, this tagline that I have at the end of every episode, which is get outside, get into nature, and make your own discoveries.
Yes.
And I'll be honest, at the time, I had no clue if television could encourage kids to turn off the television and go outside. But 6 years later, I'm very happy to report that it indeed can. I've now heard from hundreds of parents who tell me about their kids going outside in the backyard, you know, digging holes, looking for fossils. I'm sure they love me for that. And they're looking at birds flying in the trees, recognizing that those birds are actually living dinosaurs, and they actually are going outside and asking to go outside. So Dinosaur Train reaches millions of households a month in the U.S., and it's in 100 countries. So there's few things that I could do in life that are going to have as much impact as that.
For sure. I mean, let me tell you, we've been, like, geeking out. I can't explain to you how excited the two moms that you're talking to right now were that we were going to get to talk to you, you know.
Well,
you are, like,
you.
A That's superhero in our lives, Dr. Scott.
I feel like our children think we're superheroes because we're talking to you.
Yes. So thanks for giving us props.
Please tell your kids that Dr. Scott sent along a big T-Rex-sized hello.
Awesome. Oh, man, totally will.
Yes.
So tell us, what kind of advice do you have? You know, we've talked a lot about lead by example with parents being important in getting children involved in nature, but what kind of advice do you have for parents that aren't necessarily outdoorsy themselves? Like, oh, April, don't point at me. Sorry. I love nature, and I do enjoy being outside, but I have to do it in small doses because I cannot take the heat very good.
Yeah.
I know, isn't that ridiculous? I'm from the South.
No, I know lots of people like that. So what can parents do?
Yeah.
I think that it's a matter of finding. You don't have to be the key nature mentor in your kid's life. If you recognize that this is something that you believe in and value, there's all kinds of opportunities. One of the greatest ideas that I've heard recently for connecting kids with nature is family nature clubs. And if you go onto the Children in Nature Network website, you'll find this kit that you can download.
Yes.
You can start your own family nature club, and it just means that as few as two families, as many as 100 families, we'll get together periodically and get kids outside. And it's ideal because the grown-ups hang out together and do grown-up stuff, and the kids are hanging out together doing kid stuff, sort of within eyesight and earshot of the grown-ups, but still out on their own. So that's one way. And if you don't go on some of those things, but your kids go, guess what? Those kids will be super excited to go because they're going to be able to hang out with lots of other kids their age. And that's what, of course, they really want to do.
Yes.
So that's one way of doing it. Another way is to grow a garden and just have the kids out in the backyard so it could be as close as the backyard. I mean, the nature connection happens close to home. It's great to go to the national parks and out into wilderness areas, but real nature connection happens through that daily, abundant, hands-on, multi-sensory exposure to nearby nature. So it might be schoolyard gardens. It might be some kind of after-school activity with a boys and girls club. It could be these family nature clubs. It could be sitting in the window and looking outside at the birds and listening to them, just spending a few minutes a day, you know, with your ear to the window, trying to hear what's going on outside and understand what birds are around that day. So it's really easy. It can be very close to home. It typically is free, so anybody can do it. And nature is pretty much everywhere. Now, having said that, there are some communities that are less nature-rich than others. But even then, it turns out to be a simple solution. You just go buy some seeds, plant some native plants. Those native plants attract native insects, and those native insects attract native birds. AKA dinosaurs, and lots of other animals. So you can do that right in your backyard or your courtyard or your schoolyard or wherever.
Oh, that advice is awesome.
So that kind of ties in with the next question. We frequently hear the term it takes a village when we talk about child development. What community efforts would you like to see to create a bond between children and nature?
Wow. I absolutely do say that in the book, too, that
yes.
It turns out that parents are exactly the wrong people to be nature mentors, especially as kids get to be teenagers, because, of course, teens really don't want to hang out with mom and dad. I have a 12-year-old who's 12 going on 15, and she would much rather hang out with kids her age and maybe some 20-somethings that are, overseeing their activities so they don't get into too much trouble. So that's where having aunts and uncles, both literal and figurative, in kids' lives is wonderful. That's where these family nature clubs can be terrific. That's where sending kids to camp or getting them, cooked up with groups that are going out and doing activities outdoors can be great, and the kids are getting really excited. But the other thing in the long run that communities can do, and I think that this is equally important, is think about what kind of a future they want with regard to nature in that community. We typically think of cities as the places where the wild things aren't, where the there's not much nature. And in fact, there's typically quite a bit of nature around, but we also need to rewild or renature our cities with these native plants, etc. And I think we're going to need some community collaboration to get there. And so in Denver, that's why my family and I moved out here to Colorado a couple of years ago from the California coast, where we could hear the ocean when we woke up in the morning. We certainly don't hear any ocean here in Colorado, but we came here because it was an opportunity to work through a major natural history museum and use that museum as a platform to connect with other groups in the community and think about how we would like to transform this city into a place where both people and nature can thrive.
Yes.
And what would that look like? How would we make it happen? How could we collaborate with organizations so that each one is like a different tool on a Swiss Army knife with a unique set of skills and talents that we can bring together, and we can leverage each other's assets to do things that no one institution could ever do.
Wonderful.
So we are in Florida, Dr. Scott, and it is already getting seriously hot here. Do you have any suggestions or great resources or ideas that can help kids connect with nature when it's so hot and buggy outside in the summer?
Yeah, where are you in Florida?
We're in Sarasota, Florida. So we are.
I love Sarasota, Florida.
Oh, hooray!
I do.
You should come visit us.
My wife is from Florida.
Okay.
We visit Sarasota almost every year so that we can go to Siesta Key, and we stay on Siesta Key.
Well, there you
go. It is gorgeous. So, things you can do around that area. Of course, you have Moat Marine,
yes,
where you can go take a boat out under the water and go do all kinds of cool things, traveling to the islands to see birds and all that kind of stuff. There's lots of islands, and if you go inland, there's all the lakes and the fishing and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you can do, and most people just don't think about it, but you can go out at night. And if it's hot, nighttime's always cooler, and you go out at night, and there's a whole different set of animals out there. It's like a changing of the guards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sun sets, and one set of animals goes to sleep, and the other set wakes up. And you go out at night, and you will see and hear all kinds of marvelous things. And especially if you get a headlamp and go wander around, kids love it. Being out at night is one of the best ways to connect kids with nature because it's so mysterious and different than the daytime. And you engage all these other senses beyond your eyesight. So I would say that that's a great thing to do, too, in the heat of the summer.
Oh, man.
Yes, absolutely. My children love going out with their headlamps in the yard, or if we're camping. We have wonderful nocturnal animals in Florida, and moths and bats and such. That
all kinds of good creepy crawlies to check out. Dr. Scott, what inspired you to write a book about children and nature, specifically that topic?
Well, I think I did it for the health of children, the health of the places that they live, and the fact that there was no other book out there that did this. You might be familiar with Richard Louv's best-selling book,
yes.
Last Child in the Woods, and that was published 10 years ago. And that rang the alarm bell and helped to trigger the Children in Nature movement. But since then, there hasn't been a follow-up book that really talks about how to connect kids with nature, including how that process changes as kids grow up. So I decided to do the research and try and fill the gap and offer parents and teachers and other caregivers some easy tools that they could start using tomorrow to help kids connect with nature.
So what research did you do or feel that's necessary to write this book, and how much of it was influenced by how you were raised and how you parent?
Wow. So I did a lot of research for this book. The book was written over the course of about a year, but it was researched over the course of probably 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Off and on. And at the back of the book, there's a pretty long bibliography, and I don't talk too much about the studies in the book so that people don't get turned off and it's not too academic, but I include the studies at the back for anyone who's really interested.
Yes.
It turns out that research into children and nature has really only taken off in the past 15 years, and really a lot of it just in the past 5 to 10 years. Before that, most people didn't even really think too much about nature. That psychologists, for example, thought about the human mind, but only in the realm of cities. They never really went beyond the city boundaries. But nowadays, there are multiple fields of psychology, like eco-psychology, environmental psychology, even evolutionary psychology, that are looking at the connection between kids and nature. There's also all this amazing research on neuroscience and brains. There's something called a functional MRI, which is this tool that can look at how the brain is functioning in real time as somebody is actually being really active.
Mm.
So that kind of data has come into use and really helped us understand how brains work. There have been people who've studied the physical effects as well of nature on people. It turns out that, like, your stress level, the amount of the hormone cortisol goes down if you spend time outside in natural places. So all of these different fields have come together to point in the direction that says we need to have nature in our lives. And then if you add on to that the education potential, there's all this research into place-based education that says that if you get kids learning outside and engaging with their hands and with their bodies, that they have, no surprise, they are much more likely to be excited about the learning,
yes.
to retain the knowledge, that they do better in across the board in their courses, math, English, science, everything. And they're more likely to grow up caring about nature. And it could happen mostly in the schoolyard.
Mm-hmm. Go figure. Surprises are everywhere, everybody. Oh, man. Now, you mentioned, you know, that you have a 12-year-old, almost a 13-year-old, ruling your world. How does the process of connecting nature change as children grow and mature?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's something that I address in a sequence of chapters in the book. So it's all about cultivating passions and feeding passions that kids have at different ages. So in early childhood, say between birth and 6 years old, kids, all they really want to do is unstructured play. They don't want to be too far from mom and dad most of the time or some kind of a grown-up, and they just want to play on their own, where they're ruling the roost, they're making up the game, the parents get out of the way and let them play, and that's how they learn, that's how they think like scientists, and that's what they really need, and that's what they're not getting too much of these days. So the more free play we can give our kids, the better. Once they're in middle childhood, say between 6 and 11 years old, something like that, now kids have reached the age of competence, as I call it. It's the age where kids around the world are often put to work for the family, whether it's babysitting or cooking or working in fields or whatever it might be, because kids have the capacity to do that now. So their compulsion, their passion is to go out and demonstrate competence. So if you can give them cool chores to do or things that excite them or even things to go out and collect in nature, whether it's different kinds of rocks or sea glass or acorns or whatever that might be,
that's exciting for them, too. So play into that ability to be competent, physically competent as well. Mm-hmm. And then finally, once we get to teens and adolescents, they really desire two things. And it might not be the two things that jump to your mind. What they really desire is taking risky challenges on the one hand and doing so with their peers on the other hand. So their brains are wired to go take risks, and they really want to do it with other kids their own age. So in this case, that's the best thing to do is to set up opportunities for them to do that in nature. Because if you don't let them do it in nature, they're going to find opportunities to do it in urban settings that yes. maybe aren't really healthy. But if you've established nature as the ground upon which you their kids can go take risks, whether it's through surfing or skiing or hiking or climbing or whatever it might be, then they're more likely to go back to nature as teens and go and take risks and you know, pass through these challenges with their peers. So this is where groups like Outward Bound or summer camps can come in, or other clubs that can get kids out into somewhat wilder places where they can have these experiences. And we don't want to always shield our kids from risk. And believe me, having a 12-year-old daughter, I know it sometimes it's difficult to sort of step away, but mm-hmm. we want our kids to be taking risks, because if they're not, guess what? By the time they get to be teens, when they're going to be out there doing it anyway, they're not going to be prepared to deal with those risks because they've been shielded from them for yes. too long. So better to be that hummingbird parent rather than the helicopter
yes, and
parent.
And I love that word. I love that phrase in your book. It's great, hummingbird parenting.
Yeah,
I'm about to shout a hallelujah on that point right there.
There you go. And that just means, you know, sitting out in the periphery, zooming in when necessary, yes. and then going right back out to the periphery and increasing the distance between you and your kids as they grow up. Because nature connection is a contact sport. And both kids and nature can take it. And we've got to let them engage. We can't always say no. Too often these days, we're always telling kids, no, don't pick up that rock. No, put down that stick. No, don't climb in the tree. And for God's sake, stay out of the mud. We need to let kids completely engage, because that's Absolutely. How you start to form that bond. We can't always stay on the trail, no matter what the sign says. Because if we don't do that, then that we're not letting the kids really form that emotional connection.
Yes, that's right. Oh, Dr. Scott, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Yes. Can you tell everybody where can they grab a copy of your book?
How to Raise a Wild Child mm-hmm. is available at all major bookstores. It's on Amazon. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and you can get it there. There is a website for the book, which is raiseawildchild.com. RaiseAWildChild.com, and people can go there, or they can buy the book from that site. There's also lots of nature tips there. There's a contest. If they want to enter the contest and submit photos of kids being wild child, so to speak, then they can do that, and the contest ends soon. So get out there and do that. And I also invite parents to take the 30x3 nature challenge, where they agree to get kids, or they pledge to get their kids outdoors for at least 30 minutes three times a week. You know, it's just a matter of making a habit of it. We need to yes. think of nature connection more like literacy.
Absolutely.
The kind of thing that we insist is in our children's lives.
And thank you so much for your work in the Children and Nature movement. We definitely appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
Dr. you Scott. Have a great night.
It's been a pleasure. You too, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, man, that's it for tonight's episode of Maternally Yours. Boy, do I have a crush on Dr. Scott now. I thought I liked him before, and now I love him. We want to thank everyone who makes the conversation possible, especially our listeners and our guests, Dr. Reed Noss, Dr. Scott Sampson, and co-host April Noss.
You've been listening to Maternally Yours, your conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and early motherhood. Produced at WSLR 96.5 LPFM, Sarasota's community radio station.
Our volunteer hosts, writers, and producers are Ryan Stanley, Laura Gilkey, and Dana King. You can find our most recent podcast at maternallyyoursradio.com, where you can also contact us with your comments, questions, and stories.
Until next week, we leave you with the words of Dr. Maya Angelou. When you know better, you do better. Thanks for joining the conversation.